Hi, good to see many of you again. As most of you know, the Drug Addiction Treatment Program of OSI has been trying to help Baltimore expand and strengthen its treatment system so people can get access to drug addiction treatment that need it in Baltimore. And an important aspect of an effective treatment system is to have an outreach strategy, an engagement strategy, to get people into treatment. And then you need a continuum of services, of different types of services, with and without different types of medications, different types of counseling, behavior therapy, inpatient, outpatient, and so on, and aftercare recovery services. And that's the goal, is to have this kind of continuum of care, if you will, beginning at outreach and kind of ending in, you know, recovery services, a little treatment in the middle. And today we're going to talk about a very important, what I think is a very important aspect of these outreach and engagement services, which has a nice second effect, if you want to call it a second effect, which is that it's a first aid and life-saving intervention. So I'm going to give you a very brief background on overdose, you know, for like 2 minutes. And then turn the program over to the real speakers. This is about mostly about opiate overdose, and opiate overdose is a leading cause of death in Baltimore in terms of drug overdoses, and in a number of other cities as well. In the last 15 years, the overdose death rate of all drugs has been fluctuating around the 300 mark. It was below that this past year. But it's been fairly predictably around plus or minus 300. And the thing about opiate overdose in particular is that it's highly preventable. Obviously, the best way to prevent it is not to take opiates at all. Although it gets complicated because some people need to take opiates for treatment, whether it's for pain or for drug addiction treatment. You can actually prevent opiate overdose because we know from work that Carl Atkin from the School of Public Health did before and with some funding of ours actually 2 years ago, that in which he looked at the reason he interviewed a number of people who had previously overdosed, and he found that there were a number of factors associated with overdose, which include using alone, recent detoxification or stopping cold turkey or use, possibly depression, and using like in large bolus, like a large dose at once. And so the other thing about, so there are certain things that people could do to reduce their risk. The other thing is a lot of people, he found, people who use drugs alone are more likely to overdose because no one sees them overdose and could potentially save them. And the other issue is that opiate overdose is actually, unlike some other overdoses, maybe like cocaine if you have a cardiac arrhythmia, opiate overdose can be a slow process where your breathing slows down, you get lethargic, and you know, you get cyanotic blue and go into a coma. And so there could be ample opportunities to find people, to find them when they overdose, if you recognize the overdose, and then do something to revive them and to get help. And so that kind of creates a basis for the intervention. The other thing about opiate overdose is there's actually an antidote for opiates, unlike cocaine and other drugs, which is called naloxone or Narcan, which is the trade name. And essentially, Narcan is what is administered in ambulances and emergency rooms. And it binds to the opiate receptors, and it's very strong binding. The opiate receptors, it kicks off any opiates like heroin or narcotic analgesics off the opiates. And it has itself no effect. So it essentially reverses the effects of the opiates. And you can revive people like pretty instantly with Narcan administration, and it's not like the image a lot of people have is like Pulp Fiction, if you've seen that movie. It's very violent. If you don't like violent movies, I'm not recommending it. I thought it was kind of interesting. But anyway, where they stab like this person like in the chest and the heart with this big syringe, and you know, it's really not like that at all. You just it can be given as an IM injection in the buttock, as the English say. I guess they say that. Or and there's actually a nasal spray now that's not approved by the FDA that's being used in different places. So it's a very potent and very effective antidote. And so if you recognize overdose, if you have the antidote possibly available, and then if you know to call 911 and get the EMS people to come, you can actually keep people alive while you're, you know, doing like rescue breathing, because people remember their breath slows down. So if you do rescue breathing, you keep them breathing. And then help comes, you know, the other help. And then they can be evaluated medically. So this is a kind of a very basic common sense approach, it seems to me, in terms of first aid, keeping people alive, and then getting them into treatment, potentially. You can't go to treatment if you're dead. You know, that's a certainty, I think. That's pretty reasonably true. And so, you know, that it's really a very basic kind of apple pie and mom intervention, it seems to me. It's like first aid, basically. And there are a number of places in the world that are doing this, in Italy, in Germany, in Australia. And there are growing, actually, a number of cities that Susan Sherman from the School of Public Health is evaluating some of the programs in other cities where they're also doing this, New York and in San Francisco and Chicago. So we, I was very happy to bring Dan Bailey from Chicago Recovery Alliance here a few years ago to speak about what he's been doing in Chicago for a number of years with this opiate overdose intervention. And Peter Bjelson was here, and he said, how come we're not doing this? I mean, he literally came over to me after the meeting and said, how come we're not doing this in Baltimore? And I said, oh, gee, I don't know. You know, he thinks you think it would be a good idea. And I said, seems like it. And that kind of started a conversation and an inquiry into doing it. And we made a grant to the Baltimore City Health Department to do this, continue this work. And I think it's been quite successful and very rewarding. And so now, with that introduction, I'm going to turn the program over to Barry Waters, who is sitting over there, sorry. And he will continue the presentation.
Thanks, Dr. Swartz. Okay. I'd like to say good afternoon, everyone, and welcome you here to the Open Society, and thank you for coming. You know, we've got a pretty large group here today. It's nice to see those of you who I know, those of you who I've met before, and those of you that I work with all the time. I see you guys all the time, right? Like Dr. Swartz said, a little while back, when Dr. Peter Bjelson, the former health commissioner, came over to him and said, how come we're not doing this here? And they got their heads together, and Dr. Swartz said, well, okay, well, here's the money, let's do it, okay? I'm part of the Baltimore City Health Department Staying Alive staff, okay? And there are a couple of us here today. Myself, there's our director, Michelle Brown. There's the other health facilitator, Nathan Fields, and our senior advisor on harm reduction,
Monique Brugger.
I knew that. Okay? How does Staying Alive work in Baltimore? Okay? Here's how we operate. Our staff, okay, along with the Baltimore City Needle Exchange Program, we're part of a, what you might call a small coalition of harm reduction programs, okay? Baltimore City Needle Exchange Program, along with our staff of the Staying Alive Program, we actually do street outreach all over Baltimore and in different communities in Baltimore. And we started recruiting IV drug users, okay, to actually be able to train people in how to use Narcan, okay, to revive someone. Well, along the way when we started using recruiting IV drug users, we also had people come to us like, well, I'm a father of a drug user. I'm a mother of a drug user. I'm a friend. And I want to be able to know how to save somebody, okay? And we looked at that, and we moved out, and we expanded our recruitment to anybody who wanted to actually learn how to save somebody from an opiate overdose, okay, in Baltimore City. We constantly recruit people all around Baltimore City and from our 12 needle exchange locations. We constantly recruit people in different community agencies that we actually visit. We actually visit methadone treatment facilities and provide our training there, our curriculum in the methadone treatment facilities. We're constantly doing street outreach, community outreach, and recruiting people for our program. Also, we actively recruit people from participants who have come to our training, have taken our training, and have been involved in maybe reviving someone from an opiate overdose, and they actually take the word of mouth to the community, and it's spread a great deal that way also. Okay? The impact that it has when somebody has seen somebody revive someone from an opiate overdose, and now I want to learn that process myself, that's been a tremendous one for our recruitment process. Okay? So when and people know, and one thing that Dr. Swartz mentioned was the fact that up to 03 we had that 300 people a year figure, you know, but since this program started, okay, it's definitely one of the reasons that that figure has gone down. Okay, there's some other reasons in Baltimore maybe, but people that I work with, we cling to the fact that we're definitely one of the reasons that the overdose rate has gone down in Baltimore City since we started our pilot program in May of 04. Okay, all right, along with that, we recruit people to come to a community agency where we actually do our training. We do our training in about five different agencies around Baltimore City. In West Baltimore, there's a Healthy Start agency. South Baltimore, there's Bond Superior Center that we use. Also, we have our New Exchange and our Staying Alive outreach office that we use in the Walbrook Junction area. In the East Baltimore area, there's the Lighthouse that we use, which is part of Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and we are there every Thursday, and unless it's been maybe like Thanksgiving or something, we've been there every Thursday since May of 04, and we've done a great deal of our curriculum training at that location. Like I said, 3 days a week, we recruit people. We actually have classes sometimes as small as 2 people, and sometimes as large as 16 people, you know? To be effective, more than 16 wouldn't be appropriate for us to really be able to be effective and give everybody a chance to actually practice the rescue breathing that goes along with the training that we use, okay? And as a courtesy, we provide lunch and transportation. We'll come pick you up. You can call our number. You can make arrangements. We have a monthly schedule that we use. We'll come pick you up and bring you to our training. We have a delicious lunch that Nathan says he prepares, but I know he doesn't prepare. He actually picks it up, okay? Okay? And along the way, we've made a great deal of friends, because when you actually help somebody learn something that can help them save a loved one or a friend's life, okay, you're really tugging at the core of a heartstring. You know what I'm saying? Okay, we have once people come into our training, we have a slight registration format that we go through. There's a process. We review some rules, and then we have an in-depth curriculum. And real quickly, I'm going to go over that, and Dr. Swartz talked a lot about it. I'm going to go over part of that in-depth curriculum that we actually go through, okay? We talk about what the definition of an overdose is, okay? And our definition of an overdose is that it's a life-threatening situation, okay, when I take more drugs than my body can handle, okay? The key term is life-threatening. It does not have to be a life-taking situation, okay? Okay, the life can be saved, all right? And this is what we want to look at, all right? What the definition of an overdose is, okay? We talk about risk factors. We talk about low tolerances, and people have low tolerances when they are just come out of treatment, when they're just released from incarceration, when for some point or another they just haven't used over a period of time, okay? We talk about identifying the things that put me at risk for an overdose, okay? Because here we have the knowledge that can help save a person from even experiencing an overdose, okay? So we do talk about risk factors. Then we talk about symptoms and signs of a cocaine overdose. And here's where we get the idea about a lot of people come in and they say, Pulp Fiction. And they say, yeah, well, that particular sign of an overdose in that movie, okay, is something that we really have to downplay a great deal, okay, because we're actually talking about the process, and it doesn't involve that thing that happened in Pulp Fiction, okay? And what we have to always emphasize here is that Narcan does nothing for a cocaine overdose, okay? It will not reverse the effects of a cocaine overdose, okay? But we do explain the symptoms and signs of a cocaine overdose, and we also explain that the number one thing someone needs to do for a cocaine overdose is to call 911 immediately. Any of those signs, okay, any of the signs that we describe for a cocaine overdose, the person needs to call 911. You need to get them there like yesterday, okay? So this is what we emphasize for cocaine. Because when we talk about staying alive being an overdose prevention, okay, we're talking about overdose prevention. Okay, now, the Narcan will reverse the effects of an opiate overdose, but we also want to pass on information that can help somebody save a life from a cocaine overdose also, okay? So we talk about that. Symptoms and signs of a cocaine overdose, signs of an opiate overdose. We talk about some myths and dispel some myths of what people might believe will save somebody from an opiate overdose. We talk about things that, and we let people know that the one worldwide standard used for opiate overdose reversal is Narcan. And that's what we talk about, and that's what we show people how to administer. We introduce people to it a lot. Some people already know what it is, and a lot of people don't, but we introduce it to them at our curriculum. We're going to get to a point where we actually show people how to administer Narcan to someone who is suffering from an opiate overdose, okay? Okay, also at this point, and how to respond to an overdose. How to respond to an opiate overdose. So we've got symptoms and signs of cocaine, and we've got symptoms and signs of opiates. So therefore, we can tell the difference right away. Okay, we can identify the differences right away. Once I can identify the differences right away, I can respond right away. Because we are talking about some time factors here, so as soon as I can respond, the better off the individual will be. Okay, so we actually talk about and go over that. And we get to a point where we actually have a little term called RACE, and that's our RESPOND acronym, and we actually play that out in the actual curriculum. We actually talk about people here and talk about responding. What do I do? What does my R stand for, which stands for rouse and stimulate, and what does my A stand for, which is checking the airway, which is what does my C stand for, which is call 911, if it's available at that point, and then what does my E stand for, which is enter Narcan. So we actually describe it step by step by step what an individual should do, how they respond at this point, okay? And then at this point in person, we actually talk about after administering Narcan, we need to continually breathe for the person, so we actually provide demonstrations for rescue breathing, and then we actually let our clients actually practice rescue breathing, okay? We have mannequins there and that can actually simulate breathing techniques, and we actually let people practice rescue breathing, because it's very important to know that once I give a person Narcan, if they don't come around and show me signs of circulation right away, I need to continue breathing for that person until they do, or maybe administer more Narcan, because that's part of the thing to cover also. Okay, at this point we have a little post test of all the stuff that we went over. Okay, and I need to say my partner Nathan tells everybody that, you know, well, the standard is 80%, but we don't accept 80% in our curriculum. You got to get 100%. You know what I'm saying? So if you want to enroll in our college, you got to be a 4.0 student. Okay? So that's how we take that. Everybody gets 100%. At this point, we have a very important issue that takes place in our curriculum. At this point, we have volunteer dispensers. Okay? That actually come and write a prescription for Narcan so that the individual can get Narcan. And without these dispensers, our program would not have even began to get off the ground. Okay? And I just want to identify and introduce two or three of the dispensers that are here today. I mean, because truly, these are our MVPs. Okay? Because whatever we do, we could not do it without the help of these dispensers. Now, they think we just be struck. Well, they think we just be like saying this, but no, okay, but we really mean this. And I'd like to introduce and thank Dr. Ann Balowitz from the Baltimore City Health Department, okay? And also Ms. Laura Davidson, okay, from the Baltimore City Health Department, and from the University of Maryland, Dr. Christopher Welch, okay? And sometimes we get our little schedule thing mixed up and we can call them at a drop of a hat. Yeah, I know what you want, I'm on my way. You know, so they show up so that we can continue our program, okay?
Chris might want to say something.
Sure, Dr. Welch. Did you say he wanted to say something?
Yeah, about dispensing and what's like, or?
Sure, you want to go ahead.
I mean, just a few things. Can you guys hear me? Because I have a call. So just to kind of tell you what we do, it's not a very big piece, and actually if it wasn't for the lawyers, it could probably work without us, but we were mandated by the lawyers to be a part of this process. So, because actually the way it works, Dr. Bielenson was involved with this also. So, but we meet with each patient, just go over their health, they have a health form they fill out. We go over that with them, really make sure if they've ever received Narcan that they didn't have a bad response to it, which would obviously be a reason not to get it again. And then just talk to them about their health, and also talk to them about, you know, issues around the training, and then issues around are they looking for drug treatment and that kind of thing. So it's really just to check in with them, make sure about the Narcan. And what else I do at University of Maryland, I, you know, run a large addiction consult service there. I work in our methadone program. I work in a drug-free program. And so, you know, not related to this project, I actually see some of the people from the trainings later on that have gotten into our treatment programs or who have been hospitalized, and I get to talk to them and find out that they went through the training. And so separate from the project, I've been able to see some of these people and how they really have benefited from it. So I don't know if there are any other questions, or we can do questions at the end.
Okay, thanks, Doc. Okay, let me wrap this up. And so as you see, the dispensers are a great, great important part of our curriculum and our training and our program, okay? So at this point, once the person has been interviewed by our dispensers, where at this point we can dispense Narcan. We dispense a Narcan kit that includes a 4 ml liter jar of Narcan along with the syringes after we've actually trained the person in the process, because it's very important that we train the person in the process of administering the actual exact amount of Narcan. And that's what we do, okay? We leave no stones unturned, in that we were very professionally trained ourselves by Baltimore City Fire Department Paramedics Unit. We received extensive training ourselves from people from other, I'm going to say Stand Alive programs, but from other Narcan programs around the country. So therefore, this is something we take very serious at this point. And once we distribute a Narcan kit to an individual, we got a nice little pretty Stand Alive bag that we give everybody also, you know, to go along with that. And I want to include something right here. Our dispensers, in their interviews with our clients some time back, a lot of our clients begin to talk about, you think I can get a treatment slot? You think I can get into treatment? Can you help me get into treatment? Can you help me with this medication? Can you help me with this? Our dispensers come and they do a lot more than just talk about Narcan, okay? A lot of times some of our clients, a great deal of our clients, haven't actually talked to a doctor in a long time, okay? So they get a chance to maybe get a little feedback, to get a little information to find out where they can get into treatment. And what happens is, as a result of that, we've gotten over 20 documented cases of actually people getting into treatment, as using the Stand Alive program as a vehicle for treatment. Also, in conjunction with the Baltimore City Needle Exchange program, where we're able to refer them to a treatment slot via the Needle Exchange program for methadone treatment slots that are available. So that's another avenue that people can use to get into treatment as a result of coming through the Stand Alive program. You see, so once again, we're in that process that Dr. Swartz talked about of ending up in treatment. Okay, because our motto at Staying Alive is that if I stay alive today, then I can make another choice tomorrow. Well, Dr. Swartz made it a little more clear. You can't go to treatment every day. Okay. So, you know, that's our motto. Okay, that's what we use. Okay, and we've trained over 790 people in Baltimore since March of 2004. Okay, we've actually had over 105 reversals. People who have come to our training have actually saved over 105 lives. You know, by using our Narcan that we've taught people in this curriculum, that way back on that day when Dr. Peter Billinson went over to Dr. Swartz and said, hey, why don't we have this? And they got together and they talked about having it. So, and we've come all the way to this point. There's a lot of work for us to do and ahead of us. Okay? We've done a whole lot. We've only scratched the surface. There's a lot more that we need to do and need to be able to do. Okay? And that's one of the reasons that we're here today, okay, to actually talk about where we've come to this point and where we really, really want to go from this point, okay? So thank you very much.
Uh,
next, Michael DeFeo is going to speak to us about his experience in the program.
Good afternoon, everybody. Speaking for one who these programs are for, I can personally say that I am one of the 700 and almost 800 people who took the training and who have used it. And personally have drug reversals of four individuals. And someone said to me, it's nice to see you, Mike, and I said, it's nice to be seen. And I'm sure these four individuals that I had the drug reversals for will gladly say that they're nice to be seen, too. And the training is helpful. I spread the word to everybody that I know, you know, and they, tell everybody that they know how important it is to take this training, you know, and if you only save one life, I think it's all worth it. I really do. And that's the end of my comments. Thank you.
Dr. Susan Sherman is going to talk about the evaluation.
Thank you, Michael. It's nice for you to, as opposed to me reading the voices, which I'm going to have people, I appreciate your coming and reading the voices, being a person who's gone through this. As Robert mentioned, we are involved, it's actually Hopkins in Maryland being Chris Welch, in the evaluation. And my colleagues here today who've been involved since the beginning evaluating are Carl Lopkin, Donnie Gann, and Karen Tobin's not here, but she's been integral in the quantitative part of the evaluation. Our evaluation has two pieces, and there's a lot more information in the handout if you want to know more than... this is a weird panning. I'm going to step back. I don't want you all to feel left out. There's a lot more information that I'm going to go over, but just to say, the evaluation, there are two parts. First, we have the quantitative piece, and the second is the qualitative piece. And as you can see, we baseline 250 people, and we're following up with some of those and some others 6 months after the training on a variety of topics that are covered to see the effects of this training. Although, as Robert said, it's kind of common sense. I think a lot of what we do in public health is common sense, and unfortunately, we have to prove what we think makes sense and is right, but here we are proving what we think makes sense and works. We also did 25 in-depth interviews. We've done 19 so far, talking to people, getting their feelings, finding people's words about what this experience was for them, how it affected their lives, if it affected their drug use, talking to us about if they've overdosed and also if they've administered naloxone. And everyone we've talked to in the qualitative have actually come in for a refill, so we know that they've administered naloxone. So just to give you a little bit of who these participants are, in the quantitative survey, 32% are women, over two-thirds, 72% are African-American. As you can see, most people inject daily, which is fairly common, 61%. And these are long-term injectors, so an average of 15 years, which is typical, I think, to a lot of the folks that come to the needle exchange. Half of them reported ever overdosing, and 87% had witnessed an overdose, and that's astounding to think of how often this happens. As far as what we have so far for the quantitative results, we've talked to 50 people, and over half, 52%, reported that they witnessed an overdose in the past 6 months. And of course, we picked out what we wanted to share with you, which we were happy about with the results, that half of them called 911. A lot of people think because we're teaching people to administer naloxone, that it's not going to prevent an overdose, which that's half, as Barry talked about so well, that's half the curriculum, is how you prevent an overdose. But once it happens, we train them what you can do. Actually, Barry and Nathan train them what you can do. And so calling 911 is something really important. As was noted, a lot of people don't, and this has been found in six cities in the U.S., and it would be found in a million if
the studies had been done, people don't call 911 because 911 because they're afraid the cops are going to come and they're going to be arrested. And so Narcan provides an opportunity for them to make another choice. We were happy to find out that no one applied pain. That's something that's really typical. A lot of times people induce pain to try to wake people up when they're ODing. They put things under their nails. They throw them in the shower. They throw water on their groin. And we were glad to know that one of the things they learned in the training was that this doesn't help, particularly pain is a good thing not to inflict on someone else. And a third injected people with Narcan. So what that says to us is they obviously practiced other things that worked. Everyone didn't necessarily administer the Narcan. They did rescue breathing or called 911. Because of the fear of police and how that's integrally related with people not calling 911, we thought it was important to find out that of the 13 times the police actually did come, that no one was arrested. And that's an important thing to get out on the street, because if there's a rumor that one person got arrested for possession, for manslaughter, then people aren't going to call 911. So we were happy to find that out. A little bit more from these quantitative results. As we embark upon what the next step is going to be, of course, we've reached a lot of people through this training, but the best people to reach the most people are drug users. Are you talking to friends? Are people spreading the word? And so we were happy to know that 43% of people showed someone how to use Narcan, 31% showed them how to do rescue breathing, and 32% showed someone how to place someone in the recovery position. And I think that's a really impressive retention of knowledge. Of course, this was self-reported. All right, I'm going to give you a little bit of the highlights of the human side of the evaluation, I think, are the quotes. And it's the words from people who've actually participated in interviews that Donnie Gann mostly and me some, we did these in-depth interviews. And thus far, as I said, we've done 19 of them. So the first example is a participant correctly describing the way to handle an overdose and his confidence and certainty around doing so. This was from a 22-year-old male. Honestly, I don't mess around as much now. Like before, I put somebody in the bathtub, turn it on, put ice on them. Now it's three things that you do. You check their vitals, you breathe for them, and if you have to, rescue breathing, the CPR. And then you have the Narcan. You know what I mean. It's just a definite thing. I mean, I don't know if it's anything definite, but it's definitely a lot better than the odds if you have the Narcan. The next quote we have, you actually mentioned, Michael, spreading the word, and this is something we saw that a lot of people who went through our interviews did. People are, of course, really excited about getting other people to take the class. People are excited to be in the class. They want to help other people. I mean, you know, just like we like to help other people. Of course, there's drug users are people who have this kind of inclination as well. And something that's really important is there are a lot of people that they can reach that we may not have access to, that don't come to the needle exchange, that don't come to the training as it stands now, which is about an hour. So this is a quote from a 55-year-old male. I talk to everybody about taking the class. I'm surprised I don't have any of the literature in my pocket right now because I pass it out. I give it to everybody. I let them know when and where they give the class, you know. I think this quote from a 35-year-old male, there really were more female quotes in here. I think they happen to be the ones, this is kind of gender biased. But I think this really sums it up. It's hard when you're trying to make a short presentation. There were a lot of good quotes, what to pick. So these are the ones we felt that were the most reflective of what we were happy about that we heard. I think a person should take time out to make the class because you never know what you might learn. Everybody can teach somebody something. And I didn't have any plans on coming to Stayin' Alive, but for some reason, something's happened for a reason. And I was in the class and it helped me save one of my friends. I'd just like to say, anybody who's thinking about taking the class, you never know when you may need it and it's very helpful. Take the class. It's a piece of knowledge that's helpful knowledge that will live with you forever because we're always going to have addicts in the world. The next quote I'm going to skip over, you're welcome to read it. It's just an example of people talking about what to do. And the fact it was really impressive a lot of times in these interviews, people got all the orders right. They knew that, you know, you started with breathing was the most important thing, and you started with CPR. And Naloxone was, Narcan was sometimes a first resort because people had seen it used, and it's kind of a miracle drug. Someone's turning blue and then they pop up, as many of you might have seen physicians. Or sometimes people tried other methods. One of the things that, of course, we think it's important, one of the reasons that people do overdose is their tolerance changes or the drug changes. So one of the quotes that we had from a 22-year-old, the same 22-year-old male, his interview is actually incredible. What he learned and how this affects his drug use, he said, "I don't ever slam stuff that I don't know how good it is." Slam meaning like inject it all at once. "I don't ever do that because if I go out on my own, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't help myself." So when he's using alone and he has new drugs and he doesn't know the source, he tests it. Another argument that we often have heard in a lot of places is that Narcan actually equals may equal people using more drugs. If you know you have the safety net, then you're going to use more drugs. And we actually started asking people, this is an argument that people give, "So what do you think about it?" And this was a response. "Nobody wants to be injected with Narcan. I mean, it sobers you up and you don't want to be sober at that point, right? Nobody's going to, it'll be endangering themselves being injected with Narcan, and they'd be putting themselves in danger of getting a shot of Narcan, and nobody wants it. So no one's going to do a lot of drugs because this drug is there. The whole point of getting high is to get high, and it definitely takes away your high." Okay. The last quote, I recommend you reading the recommendations for staying alive, which this woman said, but it's a long quote. I just want to end with the last quote, which we think that it's about passing it on. "I want as many people as I possibly can, anybody I can affect, to go there and take the course, because you never know that the life they save may be mine." And that really touched us. And on that note, we want to end. And Monique is actually, Rucker from the Health Department, is going to talk about the next steps.
Hi, everybody. I think that those quotes were extremely profound. I think we could stand up here all afternoon and talk about how wonderful this program is. But hearing it actually from the clients and hearing it from Michael, thank you for coming, is really what it's all about. I just want to talk to you all briefly about the next steps of this program, because we're really, really excited. We've done great work, but there's still so much left to be done. So what we really want to focus on, I guess, in the next years, not year, but years down the line, is making a bigger impact with this program. And so we want to look into conducting trainings in different venues. What Barry stood up here and talked to you about was actually conducting trainings in the community-based organizations, but what we've really been thinking about is going out and actually conducting the trainings on a van, in a mobile unit, next to the needle exchange, actually going to clients exactly where they are. Because right now we pick up clients, we transport them to the CBO, you know, or to Hopkins, actually conduct the training and take up a big piece of their afternoon. If we were right next to the needle exchange van, Barry Nathan could just boom, hit it, and just cover the curriculum probably in about 20, 30 minutes while still maintaining the integrity of the curriculum. And then we would have a dispenser right there and actually be able to dispense the Narcan. And we'd be able to see, we think, probably double the amount of people. So it would really, really help us in terms of getting the word out. Another thing that we want to do, and again, Barry touched on this, is actually get into the jails and the prisons. These individuals, when they are released, are, of course, at high risk for overdose. You know, if they have not been using it and they go and get some drugs, you know, that's exactly what may happen, unfortunately. So if we can conduct the trainings inside the jails during a pre-release program, or just, you know, just in the jails themselves, and then arrange to actually distribute the Narcan upon release, it would just be perfect, and we could prevent a lot of deaths. So that's something else we're really looking into. And then another thing that we want to do is actually train other providers to conduct this curriculum. There's no reason to just keep it to ourselves. We can certainly, you know, pass on the word, show other people how we actually conduct the training, bring in individuals, show them how to perform rescue breathing, and then they can actually conduct the training with other people, with the clients that they see, whether it's in a drug treatment program or in other venues. That's kind of how we started, in terms of someone from Chicago coming out here and showing us how to do things. So again, that would be a perfect opportunity for us to kind of create little staying alive throughout Baltimore. And I think that that would really get the word out and help us to reach even more people. So there's other things that we kind of have up our proverbial sleeves, but these are, you know, just the things we kind of wanted to point out. The last thing that we want to do is hire a part-time nurse practitioner that we would have on the van with Barry and Nathan during select times, and they would work in conjunction with our fabulous volunteer dispensers. But having someone who's dedicated to the program will, number one, release some of the burden that we're placing right now on our volunteers, and then it would also just provide an opportunity for us to provide medical care to clients who come into the needle exchange program, which is one thing we've really wanted to do for years now. So it would kind of kill two birds with one stone, be able to dispense Narcan as well as provide medical care to these individuals. So those are just some of the next steps. We're really, really excited about what we've done. The number of reversals that is listed in here, we're pretty sure is actually an undercount. I think a lot of people don't even come back and tell us, you know, that they actually performed a reversal, and that's okay. They don't need to. We don't necessarily focus on the numbers because we have people like Michael who tell us, you know, that as long as you save one life, that's really all that matters. So I just want to end by saying thank you so much to everyone, definitely to Open Society, for even allowing us the opportunity to even have this program. We really appreciate the funding. We definitely want to thank our clients for taking time out of their day to actually come and, you know, go through this training. Obviously, we want to thank the health department staff. Barry pointed out all the Staying Alive staff, our tremendous dispensers. Thank you again. And, of course, Hopkins, we can't thank you enough for providing evaluation, helping us to see the things that we are doing well as the things that we could do better. So just thank you to everyone, and I guess now we're opening up for questions.